Hello, this is Gregory Novak. This is The Cunning of Geist, Episode 8. Welcome back. This episode is going to be about time, God, and Hegel. And I know that's a mouthful and it covers almost all and everything, but let's get into it. First, time. What is time? What do we mean by the word time? Well, I'm sure everyone knows that it's one of the most mysterious things of all, the movement of time, that life flows through time. We all experience it, but no one seems to really be able to understand exactly what is going on with time. However, I will show later on how Hegel has a very unique take on what time actually represents, and I believe it is pretty breakthrough from a philosophical, religious, and scientific standpoint, but I'll get into this more later. In this episode, we'll look at time from four different areas: science, philosophy, religion, as well as I said, how Hegel views it. Let's start first with science. Science actually has very little to say about time, and it's interesting because of all the magnificent breakthroughs that have happened in science over the last 100 years or so, and with Einstein and quantum physics, the notion of time is still pretty much a mystery. Einstein, in fact, famously said that time was a stubbornly persistent illusion. And the other way of looking at it is that it is not an illusion, that it's actually part of the fabric of reality. And we'll be getting into this distinction later on. So there are two conceptions of time, as we've just briefly covered. A more complete way to discuss it is that the first way to look at it is what is often called the A theory of time, and that is that time is a process, that time, in fact, is tensed, that time existed in the past, it was, it is now, and will be in the future. So there's a flow. The other interpretation, and this is the Einstein interpretation, is that it's called the B theory of time, that it's the static theory of time, that time is, in fact, tenseless, that all time is the same. Every moment is as real as any other moment, and it's just us human beings that somehow follow this arrow of time. But in reality, there is only one big block of space-time, and that the future is as much determined as the past. Obviously, in the A theory of time, there's an element of freedom, the possibility of change, that the future's not quite set in stone yet. Where in the B theory of time, there is no possibility of freedom. Everything has been predetermined. And again, we covered this before, but the terms, the A theory of time and the B theory of time, actually come from a philosopher in the early 20th century, McTaggart. And he actually wrote a lot about Hegel as well. But moving on, in terms of how science views time, it actually doesn't view time as a separate thing at all. Einstein showed that time is actually part of space-time. And according to current theory, space-time began to exist at the Big Bang some 13 or 14 billion years ago. Now, the only thing in the known universe that science claims follows the era of time, other than our own perception of it, is a thing called entropy. And entropy really just means how much disorder or order there is in a particular system. And what science has found is that in the universe, that we are moving from a highly ordered state to a more disordered state. As time goes on, the universe becomes more disordered. The universe is expanding, and this creates greater disorder. But that is the only thing that speaks to the era of time in all of science. All the laws of physics, everything else, it could go backward or forward equally well. We all know that you can break a glass on the floor, but you can't just rewind the situation and have the pieces of glass come back and form the glass. If you pour some cream in a cup of coffee and stir it around, you can't get that cream back out of the coffee by stirring in reverse or anything like that. Those are common examples. Many people feel that, many scientists believe that somehow that this concept of entropy is very much linked to the concept of time. Stephen Hawking writes about this. However, just because entropy shows a direction in the flow of time, that doesn't mean that that's what time is. Another interesting thing about space-time is that it has a certain plasticity to it. Time can speed up and slow down depending on how fast you travel. For example, there's a way to look at this is if you had two twin brothers that were on Earth, and one of the brothers was able to get in a spaceship and leave Earth and accelerate to, say, 3/4 the speed of light, and then turn around at lunchtime and come back, traveling at 3/4 the speed of light. Well, he may get back and find that his twin brother is now 80 years old, older than him, and that he may, in fact, be dead. Obviously, the equation works depending on how fast the brother in the rocket ship goes, but clearly the brother in the rocket ship experiences a different sense of time than the one brother that was back on Earth. And this has been proven, actually, in experiments. If you put an atomic clock on a satellite that's traveling around the Earth at a very fast speed, it will actually slow down to, in terms of microseconds compared to a similar atomic clock on Earth. So this has been demonstrated. Also, it's interesting that when we look up in the sky and look at the stars, we're actually seeing the past. It takes light a certain number of years to reach us from the stars, and the further away a star is, the longer it takes to reach us. That's why these telescopes that are up out in space right now, they can look back almost to the Big Bang itself. I mean, they're getting very close to seeing what the initial universe looked like. And again, this is literally looking back into the past. And we'll be getting back to this concept a little more later on. So science says that time, actually space-time, began its existence at the Big Bang. Well, what happened before the Big Bang? Let's move now into the subject of religion and talk about what happened before the Big Bang. There's a philosopher and Christian theologian, William Lane Craig, who's discussed this and written books on this in detail. He's currently a professor at Houston Baptist University in the United States. He's best known for two things, actually. One is for promoting the Kalam cosmological argument for God, and I'll explain this in a minute. And secondly, he's known as a fierce debater, and he's gone up against these modern atheists like Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and others, and he's debated them in some pretty famous stage debates. As a matter of fact, Richard Dawkins, who's also one of these modern atheists, he refuses to debate William Lane Craig. And it's funny, with Sam Harris, when he did debate William Lane Craig at Notre Dame, he opened up by saying that Craig has put the fear of God in many atheists. And Sam Harris said before he went on to the debate stage, he got many emails and texts saying, "Brother, don't blow this, because this is important." So just goes to show the respect that these atheist thinkers have for William Lane Craig and his ability to present arguments. Well, let's talk about the Kalam cosmological argument. Kalam actually refers to medieval Islamic scholasticism, and it was a school of thought and study. And what William Lane Craig has done is he's taken a cosmological argument for God and rephrased it for today. And it goes something like this. Number one, whatever begins to exist has a cause. Number two, the universe began to exist at the Big Bang. Three, therefore, the universe must have a cause. And four, as such, the universe must have an uncaused creator, which has to be beginningless, changeless, immaterial, timeless, spaceless, and infinitely powerful. It sounds a lot like what people call or refer to as God. So, William Lane Craig uses the Big Bang as the creation event and says that it was caused by God. And this is his Kalam cosmological argument. An important point of his argument is that he also rejects the notion of an actual infinity. He does not believe there can possibly be an infinite past that's real. And he believes that there's no such thing as an actual infinity. It can't, something infinite cannot exist actually in the universe. For example, if you can think of an infinite number of red balls, for example, or the infinite number of numbers, but there cannot be an infinite number of actual red balls existing somewhere in a planet somewhere. If you had an infinite number of red balls, you could always add another one and another one and another one. So it could never actually be a finite thing. Craig says that this proves that there can't be an infinite past, that it supports the notion of a timeless creator, God, creating the universe in the Big Bang. However, I do believe that he's missing something here. There's another way to look at time, and that is as a circle. And that can be actual. Circles do exist. And this is a difference, what Hegel calls true infinity versus false infinity. The actual infinity of the past may be a false infinity. So Hegel would agree with Craig on this point. However, the circle would allow for an infinity. You can keep going around the circle forever, and that can be actual. And I'll talk about this more in a moment. Let's summarize before we move on. Let's summarize what religion has to say today about God's role in time and God's role in the creation of the universe. First of all, in the Bible, it's very clear that time exists for God as well as for people. God created the heavens and the earth in 7 days. So obviously there were days, there wasn't a sun then, but the Bible still uses the reference that we use for keeping time. So God not only created the world in his time, and we all exist in that time, but he interacts with people in the Bible in the flow of time. So in that sense, God is very much in time and always has been in time. However, this has not been the view, say, over the last 2,000 years of traditional religionists. They tend to view God more as a timeless, eternal, unchanging being that's above and beyond this world. This may have started with Plato and his concept of the eternal forms. Thomas Aquinas continued this view of God. Philosophy, for the most part, held on to this view all the way through Descartes and Kant. And it wasn't until Hegel came along that a dramatic change in this view occurred. We'll get to this in a moment. So to summarize the current views on God's relation to creation, you have, number one, the view that God was always in time, even before the creation of the Bible, and will remain in time. This is the view that's in the Bible. And today, an example of someone who believes this would be Nicholas Walterstorff, who's the philosophy professor at Yale Divinity School and has written on this. A second concept is that God was timeless before the creation of the world, but once he created the world, at that point, he entered into time along with the world and us humans. This is the view that's expressed by William Lane Craig. A third way to look at this is that God remains timeless. Even as creation moves through time, God is always still eternal, changeless, timeless. And this is the view, as I expressed before, that was held through much of Christianity and through most philosophers up until the time of Hegel. An example of this today would be Paul Helms, who's a philosopher and theologian at Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia, in Canada. And there's a fourth view here, which is called by some the Oxford School of Thought on this. And this is the Oxford School is actually coined by William Lane Craig, even though he doesn't follow it. And probably the primary advocate of this way of thinking is Alan Paget, who's the professor of theology at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, in the U.S. And what Paget and the Oxford School philosophers believe is that God does not experience temporal time as we do, but he does have a higher order of temporal succession in his being. You may want to call this metaphysical time. It is linked to our time somehow, but it's not part of our time, and it's something bigger and grander. And in fact, Paget credits Hegel directly for making this discovery. You can read about this in Paget's book, God, Eternity, and the Nature of Time, on page 53. Hegel, as we've discussed in all the episodes up to this point, has a different view about God. That God broke with the view that the God is beyond and above and perfectly timeless. He said that the God actually exists now in the world through Geist, through spirit, and is working its way through history within us. Just to back up a little bit, you know, we talked about Hegel's notion of becoming. It's the core of his philosophy. It's a core of being, and we discussed this in detail in episode 3 of The Cunning of Geist. And that spirit, mind, Geist comes into nature and evolves through us. And I talked about this in a lot of detail in episode 5 on Christianity and Hegel's take on this. And Paget points out that this was a really remarkable breakthrough in thinking. And this notion of working itself out in history continues with us today, that God as a human spirit is working itself through nature. It's continuing to develop and evolve. Just to step back again, Hegel in his Science of Logic says that at the end of the logic that pure being creates nature freely on its own. Now, this is debated by Hegel scholars as to whether this is meant literally or figuratively, or I would say maybe it's you can look at it both ways. But the point is that this did not occur in time. There wasn't the time we experienced before the creation of nature. It's logically prior. That logic is logically prior to nature. But it's not that there was a creation event in time that created nature. That there was, however, as Paget points out, there must have been some higher order of change or evolution that was working through this. As we said, it's a hard concept to understand, but spirit and Geist is working itself out through the finite world. Now let's actually read some Hegel on this, because this is some pretty good stuff. This is, for those of you in the Hegel study group, this is from the Philosophy of Nature, paragraph 261, Remarks, and it's on page 239. So I quote Hegel: "Just as time is the simple formal soul of nature, and according to Newton, space is the sensorium of God, so motion is the notion of the true soul of the world." And then a few paragraphs later, he states, "Circular motion is the spatial or substantive unity of the dimensions of time. The point tends toward a place which is its future and vacates one which is its past. But that which is behind it is at the same time that at which it will arrive. and it has already been at the after towards which it tends. Its goal is the point which is its past. The truth of time is that its goal is the past and not the future. That's really a remarkable statement. And I guess the question is, what does this mean? Well, there are two possible takes on this. One is basically that what Hegel is saying here is that the future is determined by the past. In other words, there's a past, there's a flow, there's a cause, and what happens in the future is directly related to what happens in the past, that it's already been determined. However, in this view, there's no freedom. This is pure determinism, and I don't think it really gets to the core of what Hegel is stating. The other way to look at it is that there does exist freedom, and although the future may be highly determined, there is the possibility to change things in the moment. And these two views lead to two different scenarios. The first, when there's everything's predetermined, leads to if time is a circle, it leads to a eternal recurrence of the same thing. It's like watching the same movie over and over again, or reading the same book over and over again. You might experience it as being in the moment being real, but it's just a recurring thing that happens over and over again. The second way to look at this eternal recurrence is that there is the possibility of change within the recurrence. And this is probably best shown in the contemporary movie Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray, where he has to revisit the same day over and over again, but he's aware of it and he's able to make changes in what he does. It's also more recently shown in the television series Russian Doll, which is produced, written, and starred Natasha Lyonne. Based on Hegel's full body of work, we can say that he certainly embraces the concept of eternal return as expressed in Groundhog Day and Russian Doll, that we do have a freedom to act within the circle of time. Although a lot is predetermined, we can be an active creative agent. We talked about true infinity and what that means in episode 4, and that's really what gives us our freedom here in the world and the possibility for change. So just to back up on one point, what was going on with Geist logic, spirit before the Big Bang, you know, before humans appeared? Well, certainly Geist may have been working itself through nature and evolving in nature to the point that of life and then self-aware creatures, self-aware thinking creatures like us. As Hegel states, nature is just an othering of pure being, of nature, of logic. And it's not like it disappears and goes somewhere. So it's continuing to work through nature. And it obviously did this before life appeared. There's a current theory in science called panpsychism, which supports this notion. There are different takes on it as well. But the point is this notion of panpsychism, that mind had some role in the early stages of development of the universe, has been taken seriously by more and more people today. So according to Hegel, Geist has always been a part of nature. And if the goal of the future really is the past, is there a way to relate this to science? And lastly, we're going to take a look here at something called the participatory anthropic principle. I've mentioned this before. John Wheeler wrote about this and discussed this, as many other physicists. John Archibald Wheeler, born in 1911, died in 2008, spent most of his career at Princeton. He was a quantum physicist. He coined the term black hole. He worked on the Manhattan Project to make the atomic bomb. He worked with Niels Bohr on explaining nuclear fission. And later on in his career, he developed this notion of the participatory anthropic principle. It's a mouthful. And what this is that consciousness has some role in bringing the universe into existence. Now, what do we mean by this? It suggests that conscious thinking observers, when looking at the past, when studying the past, like as we do now, we study the Big Bang. The Big Bang wasn't always a concept. It just came into being, you know, some 50 years ago or so. When we study the past and look at it, we are, in a sense, making it real, making it actual. Remember, light travels to us over thousands of years, and we can look at events that were occurring, well in the past. And the PAP suggests that when we study these things, when we learn about them, we're in fact making them real. That using quantum theory, we are actually collapsing the wave function in quantum physics, which takes it away from being just a probability of different outcomes to an actual event. And this is a really intriguing concept. It means that as conscious observers measure the universe, we actually create it, what's gone in the past. And this is, obviously Hegel wasn't a quantum physicist, but this is consistent with his point of the circular time. So we are in effect making real the past from which we come and which we are moving to, which again is a very startling concept. So Hegel, as we've seen, views time as being circular. Prior to the Big Bang of science, there must have been some type of metaphysical change that was going on, which is occurring, that is somehow linked actually to our future. So to conclude, the Big Bang was the beginning of space-time, but we've seen that it may have been the result of logic, pure abstract being, othering itself to become real. Yet pure being at that point was not something that was just timeless, senseless. It had a movement, a motion of its own. Even in the science of logic, when you work through it, it has a movement. It is becoming. As I said before, becoming is a core notion of Hegelianism. So we must conclude, like Alan Paget, that some higher form exists than just our sensory time, a higher form of movement. This probably existed prior to the Big Bang and will exist sometime in the future. It's hard to know. There's so many more questions we need to answer on science. And obviously, I'm extrapolating Hegel's views to what we currently know now in quantum physics and trying to make some correspondences here. But I think the key thing, as we've been stressing in all these episodes, is that Hegel teaches that our freedom is in us and we are in a position to secure this future and make this world a better place. So I want to thank you again for listening to this particular episode and all the episodes. We're getting many good responses to the Cunning of Geist podcast. And again, thanks for coming, and we'll see you next time.